We're going to continue today looking at the life of the Buddha, and one little bit after another we'll take an event from the life of the Buddha and then offer some reflections on it. We're not so much concerned here with giving a biography or life story, but more just looking at what events in the Buddha's life were deemed to be significant from the Buddha's own perspective, as well as this perspective of the tradition, and to see what the significance of those things may have for us. Yesterday we looked at the account of the Buddha's growing up and his life of luxury, or what was seen as luxury at that time, and which today perhaps seems mostly to be fairly simple lifestyle. Then on the first day we looked at the story of the Buddha's birth. One of the things that's interesting, just to even comparing those two different stories, is to see what a very different tone that they had. That the story of the Buddha's birth is very much accompanied by lots of miracles and lots of extraordinary events. We could say that it's like CGI enhanced, right? So the story of the Buddha's birth is a bit like it's a bit like watching Harry Potter to understand what English public schools are like. There's probably some truth to it, right? There's probably something about it which is how it's like, but obviously probably not a lot that is also not quite exactly literal. Anyway, so moving on today, we have another event, and this other event that we're going to talk about today is the experience of the Bodhisattva's meditation when he was young. And this is a famous event, and it's told by the Buddha out of chronological order. That is to say, he tells it in the context of when he's practicing later in life. So we're not going to do that today. We're going to look at his later practice on subsequent days, but for today we're just going to look at this event as it happened to him when he was a child, or when he was young. Doesn't actually. Anyway, well, let's read the passage as it's in the Pali. So this is the Buddha speaking much later. In fact, there's like a double recall here, because it's the Buddha telling the story about how when he was practicing before he was enlightened, and remembering that when he was practicing before he enlightened, he was remembering something that happened when he was a child. Okay, so it's like a flashback within a flashback that we've got here. All right. So it occurred to me, I recall sitting in the cool shade of the rose apple tree while my father, the Sakyan, was off working. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unskillful qualities, I entered and remained in the first absorption, which has the rapture and bliss born of seclusion, while placing the mind and keeping it connected. And the Bodhisattva, in his reflections, went on to think, could that be the path to awakening? Stemming from that memory came the realization that is the path to awakening. Okay, so we'll look further at the context of that in subsequent days, but the basic event here is very simple, and even though it's very brief, but it gives us a little bit of context for understanding the Buddha's early life. So he says that while his father was off working, he sat in the cool shade of the rose apple tree. Now, there's nothing in the account that tells us how old the young Siddhartha was at that point. In I think some of the traditional retellings of this story does give an age, although I'm not sure how seriously we could take that, but I think he's said to be about 10 years old or something like that at the time. Nor does the story tell us anything about what his father was actually doing at the time. According to the traditions, the Buddha's father, Suddhodana, was a king, and he was at that time performing the royal ploughing ceremony, which would have been a fertility festival where the king, as the lord of the lands, would have presided over the tilling of the first soils of the season. And that may be the case. The Buddha, the Buddha's father, wasn't a king in the sense that we think of it as a king, but would have been more like a head of a landed household. But still, may well have been involved in a ceremony of that kind. But the text itself doesn't really say that. It just says he was away working. So we're left to imagine what he might have been doing. And while he's there, Siddhartha just sits under the rose apple tree in the cool shade. And then goes into first jhana. Seems easy, right? And when you look at that story, then it's easy to think that this is, you know, just another layer of legend and magic. I mean, it's quite believable that a tradition would like to attribute to its founder of its tradition that you know, he was such an amazing person that he was sitting in meditation, deep meditation, even as a child, a kind of profound meditation that even experienced meditators often might find very subtle and very hard to achieve. And of course that may be the case. I wasn't there. I can't personally confirm whether this happened. Even if I was there, I still probably wouldn't be able to tell you if he was in first jhana or not. However, there are a number of interesting features about this story. First interesting feature about the story is that it's told by the Buddha himself. And there are very, very few details about the Buddha's early life that we actually find in the early texts told by the Buddha himself. Remember that even the story of the birth was really told by Ananda. Ananda says that he heard it from the Buddha, but we don't actually have a sutta where the Buddha was saying that. The textual situation is a little bit complicated, but we won't go into that right now. But the basic idea is that the Buddha didn't really talk that much about his childhood and the things that was going up. In yesterday's discussion, the Buddha describing his life of luxury growing up, also we saw that there was, you know, it's a fairly mundane, fairly straightforward description. And that's very much characteristic of the Buddha's own words and the words we find in the early texts. So it does seem that there's a reasonable case for thinking that this is really what the Buddha said. Another interesting thing is that this account is found in very similar form in multiple texts, not only in Pali but also in Chinese and Sanskrit and Tibetan texts. And the details of it, yes, as time went on the details became elaborated, but the core story is basically exactly the same. So all of these things, I think, taken together, I think, make this sound like something that quite possibly really happened. But even more than just the textual and the historical context, what makes this event sound plausible to me is that it's the kind of thing and the kind of story that I've heard from lots of people. I don't necessarily mean exactly the same, right? But that this kind of thing happens, and it happens, I think, not infrequently. And I think a lot of meditators actually come to the path of meditation because something like this has happened, and because in their life, maybe when they were a kid, maybe then they were grown up, somehow they had some experience of something transcendent, something luminous, something still, a feeling of peace of mind, a feeling of letting go, some kind of experience that showed them that the world of the mind went deeper than they imagined, and that the reality that we experience, the ordinary reality that we experience, isn't the only reality that we can experience. Sometimes people do this by taking drugs. I won't ask for a show of hands here. But it is interesting that if we look at the history of modern history of meditation, especially in the West, that the history of meditation very much grew out of the drug-taking culture in the 1960s. And the first meditators were the first people, were also the people taking acid. And they're having these mind-altering experiences. And it teaches you something. It teaches you that your mind is creating this world that we're living in. And what's curious is that this doesn't seem to have just been the case in modern times, but also seems to have been the case in ancient times as well. In the oldest Indian scriptures, in the Rig Veda, we find a very common mention of the god who they called Soma. Now, who this god Soma exactly was is a matter of debate, but certainly seems to have been some kind of mind-altering substance. Quite possibly ephedrine, a stimulant, which is in the kind of amphetamine class of stimulants. And this Soma, this god, would infuse its devotees with a kind of divine energy. The devotees of the Rig Veda and those who followed the god of Soma weren't necessarily interested in consciousness-altering experiences of the kind that we might think of. Most of the passages talking about this thing are much more of the thing, let's get stoked and go and have a big fight and kill everybody. And so it seems to have been like often also in modern times that these were a stimulant that was used in wartime, and these were kind of like berserkers or something who would take these ephedrine and then go and smash, kill, destroy, and make off with all of the plunder and the booty from the villages that they were raiding. Not necessarily saying that that's the only thing that was useful, but that's certainly part of it. Now, there's an interesting little dimension of this which I discovered some time ago, and somebody may have noticed this before, but I'm not aware of it. But in the Rig Veda, of course, the main god in the Rig Veda is the god Indra. And Indra is a war god, and his victory or his cardinal act is to overcome the serpent or the dragon Vritra, and thus releasing the waters of the world. Now, the word Indra in the Rig Veda seems to be used mostly or solely as a personal name of this god Indra, but we also find alongside this the word Indriya. And you may be familiar from Buddhism that the word Indriya is used in the sense of like a spiritual faculty or a spiritual capacity. Huh? And in the traditional explanations of this word, it says that Indra in this context means rulership or control. And Indriya means like a controlling faculty, one that can dominate its opposite quality. That's the idea, the explanation in the Pali commentaries anyway. It may be explained differently in other traditions. Problem is, though, that the idea that Indra has a general meaning of rulership or control seems to be somewhat forced, and I don't find any support for that in any early texts. In the Rig Veda, the word Indriya is used in a rather different sense and a very specific one. Almost always, when the word Indriya appears, it's associated with when Indra takes the soma. So when Indra takes soma, he manifests his Indriya. So here the Indriya must mean something like the manifest form, or he manifests his true divine nature, right? So Indriya here is like the divine nature of Indra, or the true nature of Indriya. In other words, when Indra is about to go into battle, he takes the soma and he manifests his indriya, his true nature of Indra, and then he goes into battle and overcomes his enemies. And that's interesting because that relates to a rather peculiar ambiguity in the way that the word indriya is used in Pali. And in Pali and in the Buddhist suttas, of course, there are many different terms for this kind of thing, right? So we're talking about the five indriyas are faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. And these are qualities that are talked about in many different ways. You have the five balas, the five powers, you have the five, seven awakening factors, and many different kinds of teachings about practice. But of all of those teachings about practice, the teachings on the indriyas are treated in a slightly different way, which is a bit puzzling or a bit unique. For example, after the Buddha's awakening, he hesitates very famously to teach, and he surveys beings and says, well, there are beings with weak faculties and those with strong faculties. And so that word indriya is used in that particular context, not any other term. And I think that that relates back to that meaning that's derived from that Vedic sense. So you can think about it in that way, that indriya in this kind of sense means something like your innate potential. Right? So Indra, if you think about Indra as the god, had this innate potential of his nature to manifest as this fierce warrior, and he took the soma to manifest his innate nature. So if you think of indriya in that kind of sense, then that really kind of, you can understand that people, that there are people that have those innate characteristics that can manifest in these different ways. Of course, from a Buddhist point of view, we would say that those differences stem from past lives. What we've done in our past lives determine how strong our faculties are in this life. Now, how does that relate to the young Siddhartha sitting under the rose apple tree? Well, presumably, he had very strong indriyas and his strong spiritual potential. And so when he sat down under the rose apple tree, somehow he was able to let those manifest. And the indriyas were able to manifest without soma, which is lucky, right? One of the things which is lamented in a lot of the early Indian texts is the death of soma. And it's posited that this is refers to the fact that when the Indo-European peoples came to India around maybe 2000, 3000 BC, that the whatever stimulant that they'd had in the past, they weren't able to get it anymore in their new contexts. And so they had to find something else to access these states of consciousness. And meditation, it seems, was one of the ways that this eventually evolved into. So the young Siddhartha, not knowing anything about this, not knowing anything about meditation, presumably, not knowing anything about spiritual practices, not having any kind of initiation or transmission, not having studied anything or anything at all, just sat under a tree and got into first jhana. When I was in, I spent more than a year in Ipoh, and one of the gentlemen there who used to help to look after the monastery was a taxi driver named Chong. And he used to drive this very old, beat-up taxi. And, you know, there was no aircon, there was no speed, the speedo didn't work in it. It was all kind of beat up. And I asked him one day, I said, how do you get a license for this? And he just laughed and said, Bhante, I could get a brand new Mercedes-Benz off the showroom floor and drive it into the taxi certification center, and there's no way that I'd get a license. But if you pay the right money to the right people, you can get a license for anything. Something to think about if you're catching a taxi in Ipoh. Anyway, so uh, he told me about how he had started out in meditation and he had wanted to learn how to meditate. And he went to different temples, and in Malaysia most of the temples, well-known ones, are Chinese traditional temples, and they don't really teach meditation there. So he went round and went to place after place and couldn't find anyone to teach him meditation. And eventually he was at one monastery and he just said, oh, I've just had it, right? I've just had enough. I'm not going to go running around from place to place anymore. And so I'm just going to do it. I don't know how to meditate. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just going to do it anyway. And he sat in the hall, the Dhamma hall. And he said, you know, that day was like really kind of hot and there's lots of mosquitoes around. And he said they were doing building work in the monastery. So it was really kind of noisy and so on. He said he didn't pay any attention to those kinds of things. He just sat down there. And he said, and what was really interesting to me when I talked to him about it was how much he came alive when he talked about this. And he said, I went inside. I went inside one la. I went inside. And he was so animated. He's saying, and it's just like, I was watching my breathing and I went inside one la. And he had obviously some very powerful experience. And he said, all this is gone. I couldn't hear anything. I didn't know anything. And he stayed in that state for an hour or 2 hours and came out. And you could see that even those many years later, that event had made such a powerful impression on his psyche. It's transformative. It changes everything in your mind. But he'd spent the next 20 or 30 years trying to get back to that. And then he'd learnt meditation and gone to different teachers and practiced and all of these things, and he'd never found his way back. So this is one story, and I've heard other stories from other people. Another one, sorry, a friend of mine is a monk, and he said long before he was a monk, he thinks he first went into samadhi when he was driving a car, and he drove his car off the side of the road. Micha sati, wrong mindfulness, but. He was just driving late at night, and he'd just been with all his friends and had just been feeling like really happy and really at peace to just meet his friends and just have that really nice time with them, and just driving a long drive home through desert roads and just feeling very, very peaceful. And then just this kind of light came, and he just sort of went into this light and woke up, his car was off the side of the road. Strange, right? Strange, but I think it happens. I mean, it's difficult to say when these things are happening. It's difficult to really say what's going on, and especially when it's a memory from many years ago. But here we see that the Buddha's doing the same thing. It's obviously this event caused this powerful impression, which maybe he hadn't really thought about afterwards. And you can imagine that, like being a kid, something like that happens. I mean, when you're a kid, amazing things happen all the time, right? And you forget about it 5 minutes later. And at that time, he didn't have any context for it. Right? What does it mean? Right? You have the experience, but what does it mean? Yeah? I mean, I can even remember in my childhood, I mean, nothing nearly as profound as that, but I can remember, a time I was with my cousin, Matthew, and we were just lying out in the backyard. I can't remember where we were, maybe in the backyard, maybe we were camping or something, maybe just in the backyard and just lying down and looking at the stars. And he's a few years younger than me, and we were just looking at the stars and talking about them. And we got into this just kind of space, just being really kind of peaceful and feeling like it's really kind of moving experience just to be there. And, you know, again, all these years later, I can't remember the details of that, but I can remember the feeling of it quite clearly. And so these things, they make that impression. So again, this is why I think this episode in the Buddha's life is quite, to me, it feels quite plausible. that somebody who had obviously such spiritual potential as the Buddha should have had some experience like this as a child. So what does this tell us about meditation? Well, for one thing, as a meditation teacher, it's very humbling. I mean, am I just making it harder for people to get into samadhi? Maybe, right? I mean, I definitely think there's something to that. And we have to be very, very careful. And so this is what, you know, it's thinking about things like this. Like when I teach, I always try to encourage people to not take their meditation methods too seriously. And I think this is something that is very much a characteristic of 20th century meditation, specifically 20th century Burmese meditation. In Thailand, they don't really get so worked up about meditation methods. It's like a different kind of character. And in the Thai forest tradition monasteries, you can do whatever kind of meditation you like. Nobody's telling you should do this or you should do that. And the monks do, you know, most of them will do breath meditation. They might do like Buddho as a recollection. They usually do some body contemplation, which they do in different kinds of ways. They might do some kasina meditation of visualizing images and colors. They might do metta meditation and karuna, compassion, and different kinds of things. And the teacher will teach from their own experience, and the practice of the monks will be informed by that. But it's not like everybody's really sort of rigorously doing the same meditation method. And if you go to the teachers and you ask them, you know, this is the practice. I've seen this myself. And one monk who had previously done a Goenka meditation retreat, and the teacher was giving his own particular method of teaching mindfulness practice, and the monk asked him, well, I've been doing that kind of similar practice, but I've been doing it following the Goenka technique, and explained that technique of using body sweeping and so on. And the teacher said, sure, that's fine. And so it's not like an issue. But then what they say is just stay mindful. That's really the important thing. Whatever you're doing, it's not the particular technique that matters so much, but stay mindful. So somehow, in that particular state, there was something which was natural, something which was peaceful, and something which allowed the young Siddhartha's mind to find a natural state of peace. This is really the critical thing about that story. Somehow, his mind naturally found peace. Was he watching his breath? Maybe. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say he wasn't. Obviously, that's not critical to it. The critical thing is that just that feeling, while my father was away working, I sat down under the cool shade of the rose apple tree. That was his meditation method. Yeah? That's the detail that he thought was worth preserving. Yeah? Not about the particular details of the method that he was practicing. And I think that's very interesting, because it's pointing to the importance of that context in shaping the form of the meditation that we have. Now, why would that happen? Why would this follow the way of nature? Why is it that a young boy with no spiritual training or experience in meditation would go into a state of samadhi? It may be the case that he did that because of all of his practice in past lives, which had prepared him. And look, I'm sure that that had something to do with it, right? I mean, obviously that creates a certain potential. At the same time, it doesn't seem as if this event was particularly unique, and I suspect that if we did a proper survey, that we would find that it's actually not that uncommon. And I would think that if we asked the people in this room to talk about their experiences, we'd probably find a few people in this room who'd had similar experiences growing up. So I don't think that really explains it either. Why is it that there's a natural state that people can find peace of mind? A number of years ago, when I was in Perth, in Bodhinyana, we were talking about meditation, there was can't remember his name now, but one of the local Aboriginal elders would come to the monastery, and we used to do like community support for their community. And he came, and he was a really lovely guy, actually, and had a lot of really nice stories to tell. But, you know, we talked about meditation. He said, well, we don't really do meditation like you guys do it. But he said, what we do is that every so often I go off into the forest, into the bush, and I'll just sit down under a tree, and I just let my mind go out, and I'll listen to what the spirits are saying. So for him, meditation was a process of opening up and listening to what all of the spirits of nature were communicating around him. And of course, this is not just a spiritual practice, this is a survival skill, yeah? To be able to listen and to know what's actually happening around you is a survival skill. But there's something similar in that experience to the experience that the Buddha had, or to the experience that the young Siddhartha had. Yeah? Why is it that this kind of thing leads to peace? Well, from a Buddhist point of view, everything is impermanent. Everything comes to an end. And all of those things that are happening in your mind, all of these things will come to an end. This is the thing that we often miss out. We don't notice when we're meditating. When we're meditating, we always notice the presence of things. The presence of thoughts, the presence of feelings, the presence of sensations, the presence of sounds. And when a sound comes, our mind is drawn to it, and we notice that sound. What we don't notice is that a split second later, that sound doesn't exist anymore. And the ending of things is a part of nature. The ending of things is what's happening in your mind all the time. Every minute, as you're sitting there in your meditation, your thoughts are ending. And when you're sitting there in meditation, everybody, when they meditate, thinks, oh my God, so many thoughts happening. And nobody thinks, oh, actually, every one of those thoughts, I had 1,000 thoughts in this meditation, and every one of them has finished now. We don't notice that. We're not interested in it. But that is just as natural. It's just as natural to be peaceful as it is to be agitated. So when the young Siddhartha was sitting there in meditation, he doesn't have to do something in order to get something. Things will cease. And when everything ceases, when the senses cease and the desires cease and the hindrances cease and all the agitations and the thoughts in the mind cease, then the state, it's not that you gain a state that you call samadhi or jhana as a result of that, but samadhi and jhana are just words that we use to describe that state where those things have ceased. That's all. These are not things. Right? States of samadhi are not things. It's just a word that we use to just talk about the experience when certain things have ceased. So this is why the Buddha described the path of meditation as anupubba nirodha, a gradual cessation, step by step ending of things. So, if you want to get into first jhana, no need to do any meditation techniques. No need to do anything like that. Sit under a tree and just let everything come to an end. Any questions? Klaus? Can I leave that until another day, because we're going to be talking about that in the next couple of days. I know what you're going to be saying, and can we leave that for the next few days?
Okay.
Yeah? I don't want to not answer that. I do want to answer that, but I want to answer that in a certain context, if that's okay. Yeah, and if I don't answer your question properly at that time, then please ask me again. All right? Any other questions? Yeah. Okay. Well, you got up in the morning, so that's pretty good. Yeah. Okay, but you got up in the Yeah. But you got up in the morning, right? So that's good, right? In the Theragata, there's a line Uttahata Nisidata, get up and sit. So you got up, you sat to meditate. Yeah, yeah. I know. I'm getting there. Okay, trust me. Okay, trust me. Okay, you got up, you sat, right? That's pretty good. How many people in the world actually got up to meditate? Not many. Less than 1%, probably. Less than a fraction of 1%. You're already in the top 1% of people putting in effort just because you got up and you meditated. Yeah? Yeah. Well, it might be. I mean, you know, it's possible, right? If it's what we, even the story today, I mean, that Siddhartha didn't know the word meditation, didn't know what he was doing, but still got into deep meditation. Yeah? Yeah? So you get up and you meditate. And when you meditate, you make an effort. And when you start with the practice, you make an effort. That is what right effort is. And so what right effort isn't is a mind that's always pushing and trying to get something and trying to achieve something. This is wrong effort. Yeah? So by getting up and by sitting meditation, by applying yourself to the meditation, you're already doing right effort. And if your mind's being too lazy in meditation, then you'll know that and you'll learn that. That's why you reflect at the end of the meditation. Reflecting at the end of the meditation is also right effort, because that's what gives rise to wisdom, so you can understand your meditation. You understand doing certain things leads to the mind becoming peaceful, and doing certain other things leads to the mind not being peaceful. That's your right effort. Is that okay? Don't, you know, if you read Tenzin Palmo in Cave in the Snow, anyone know Tenzin Palmo here? Yeah, very wonderful nun, and she spent how many years in the cave in the snow? 20 years, was it? 12 years. Only 12 years. Oh. And she had this kind of meditation box, and she'd sit in this meditation box and just meditate all day, every day. And then at the end of it, and someone was asked, you know, is there anything that you regret? Or anything that you think that you could have done? And her answer was that she thinks she probably didn't try hard enough. So that mind that thinks that actually I should be doing something more, that mind is not going to go away, right? And you might get up and you might do twice as much meditation, and you might try twice as hard in meditation, and you'll still have that feeling that you should be trying harder. So the point is not that you don't have an effort in your meditation. The point is that your effort is led by wisdom and not by just a mind that's compulsively wanting to do more because you haven't got there yet. Yeah? And it's more challenging to let the mind find its own way because then you have that wisdom of observing how things actually work. I can give you another example from my own experience. When I was in Thailand, I stayed at a while at a very small, very simple forest monastery near Warin Chan Rap, and the abbot there was a monk called Lumpur Hom, and he was very, very lovely older monk. And there's a couple of other old guys who were there. They were like in their 70s, and they'd ordained late in life, and just rice farmers who were just, you know, taking the opportunity to do some practice as they were too old to farm. In fact, even though they thought they were too old to farm, one of them, their family, still came and begged them to come and work on the rice paddies, even though he was like 75, and he's like, come on. Anyway, so one time there was a fire out the back of the monastery, and not like this, these fires in Thailand are not really dangerous like the fires in Australia, but still. And this was, there was like a, it was a grassy area out the back, and there were some places where there's like these kind of tall patches of grass, like bamboo and stuff. And this fire was going through, so we had some brooms and things like that for putting the fire out, and we went out to go and put it out. And the fire was sort of burning through this big patch of tall grass at the back, and there's been a big flames leaping up and so on. And I thought, wow, that looks really dangerous. We should, you know, do what we can to put it out. So I sort of rushed in and started trying to put it out, and all the old guys were just standing around just doing nothing. And I'm like, come on, do something. I was rushing. And they just said, just cool it, will you? And they just waited. And you waited for a few minutes, and the fire burnt through that patch of brush and came to a very bit where the grass was very low, just a few inches high, and then just went in there and put it out. Yeah? So that's right effort. Yeah? It's based on wisdom. Yeah? I thought right effort was jumping in there and working as hard as I could, but I was wrong. Right effort was waiting and watching and knowing the right time to do just a little bit of effort. Yeah. Maybe. Yes. The mind getting peaceful is cessation. Yeah. Right? Sometimes that's all you can do, right? As long as you're not doing anything harmful. Yeah. Yeah.
Yesterday you mentioned the finger pointing to the
knee. Right. Uh-huh. Right. Is the Buddha sitting under the rose apple tree? Is that like the moon without the finger? It kind of is a bit, isn't it, right? I mean, and I guess that's perhaps the, you know, one of the special qualities of the Buddha, like the rising of right view is said to have two factors, is the internal reflection, yonisa manasikara, and the voice of another, paradoghosa. And for most of us that's true, but of course the Buddha realized for himself. And I think that that's, again, to me that's a kind of a realistic thing, right? That there's usually, in most fields, there's somebody who's a pioneer who actually realizes things for the first time, and then everyone else follows and learns from them. So I guess in that case, yeah, there was a moon, he found the moon by himself without the finger. Yeah. Yes.
Yesterday you mentioned that Mahatma Sutta was as one to be breathing and one to be breathing.
Right.
This morning you were discussing this as part of the people, the 50 factors, and the other was Sutta Yoga.
Right.
How do you think that to the text about the Sutta Yoga very awareness of the breathing?
Okay, so. I'll just repeat your question for the microphone, but so the question was this morning we talked a bit about sampajanya, and so the question was in the mindfulness meditation, what's the relation between the qualities of sati and sampajanya? Or, as I translate it, mindfulness and situational awareness. Okay, so first thing is that, of course, these are very closely related things. It's not like they're sort of fundamentally different things. However, the tendency is that the main use of sampajanya is in the context of, like, what we were talking about this morning, of a situational awareness of your body and where you are and what's the context and those kinds of things. It's not to say it's the only usage of it. It's also used in the context of meditation, in the jhanas and other places as well. But that's the primary context. The primary context that mindfulness or sati is used in is in meditation itself. Right? Again, not the only context. Sati is applied in every aspect of Buddha's teaching, and as the Buddha said, just like salt is useful in every dish, mindfulness is useful everywhere. That's true. But the primary context that mindfulness is used in is in the context of actual meditation. You know, one sits down cross-legged, sets body upright, and satting upattapettva, one establishes mindfulness. Parimukhang satting upattapettva. So what does mindfulness mean in that kind of context? Well, what mindfulness means in that context is has something to do with a continuity of awareness. Right? Something to do with bearing in mind. When we're watching the breath, watching the mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati, we're keeping the breath in mind. It's a translation by Venerable Tanisaran. I think it's actually a good one. It's a bit idiomatic, but I think it's a good translation. So what that means is that mindfulness, because mindfulness also means memory, and so mindfulness has this idea of maintaining a continuity. It's remembering the fact that you're meditating. So think about what happens when you sit down to meditate. Usually you sit down to meditate, you can say, okay, I'm going to start watching my breath, and then a minute later you've forgotten about what you're doing. Right? That's your loss of mindfulness. You've forgotten what you're doing. So to remember and to bear in mind the breath is that quality of mindfulness. Yeah? Right. Yeah, yep. Exactly, yes. Yeah, so you're exactly right. So that's the role of sampajanya in that context, is sampajanya is, you think of sampajanya as like a practical applied wisdom, right? Not a transcendental wisdom, but a practical applied wisdom that knows, oh, here I am meditating, it's not appropriate for me to be thinking about that, you know? Or you understand what the different natures of your thoughts are and how the meditation's going and being able to distinguish between the different kinds of thoughts and so on. This is the role of sampajanya in meditation. Yeah. Right. Class. Yeah. Right. Right, right. Right. Right, right. Right. Right, yeah. Okay, sure. Okay, sure. Okay, so the first one, parimukha. So in the standard phrase for beginning meditation, it says, ita bhikkhave bhikkhu aranya gato varuka mula gato. So here a bhikkhu who's gone to the forest or the root of a tree, sits down cross-legged, sets their body upright, and establishes mindfulness parimukhang and then it goes on to talk about the meditation. And this word parimukhang is a little bit obscure, and it's not entirely clear what it means. The word mukha, pari is a prefix which means sort of around or full or through or something like that, and mukha means mouth, but also face, but also entrance, but also basis, but also anyway, it's got a bunch of different meanings, so it's not entirely clear exactly what it means. In an ordinary language setting, in the Pali text anyway, the only usage of parimukhang apart from this passage is in a Vinaya passage where the monks were growing beards around their mouth. Okay? So this is obviously has a literal sense, right? So in that case, obviously, it does mean literally around your mouth, but whether that means the same thing as in the meditation context, of course, is another matter. And this is something which has been in the early on from the Abhidhamma Vibhanga. So we're talking, you know, not very long after the Buddha, maybe a couple of hundred years, depending on, you know, the date of that particular passage, maybe a bit longer, but certainly not very long after the Buddha. Parimukhang is defined as being, what does it say? Agnasika or something like that, so at the tip of the nose. So they were taking parimukha to mean like a physical location at the tip of the nose, and that's often a recommendation which is still found today. And since it was found in quite an early text, it certainly shouldn't be dismissed lightly. However, one of the problems with that interpretation is that the phrase parimukhang is not just used in the context of breath meditation. Right? It's used as a general precursor to any kind of meditation. So it might be just abandoning the hindrances, or it might be, in fact, that's probably the most common occurrence that it's in. It's not actually preceding breath meditation as such, but preceding abandoning the hindrances. It also comes before, say, doing Brahma Viharas. So the idea that it specifically means a physical location at which you're observing the breath seems to be at odds with the way that it's treated in the suttas. So then it's a bit obscure and people have different interpretations. I don't think that there's a certain answer to that, and it's certainly possible that it does have a physical or spatial meaning. But I tend to think that in Pali you have a common kind of idiom where words are repeated in a phrase, but they basically have the same meaning. So you have a word like, say, sadhangadi muchati, for example, like a phrase sadhangadi muchati means to decide upon one's faith. It really just means to have faith, but you sort of repeat two words that have basically the same kind of meaning. And I suspect that that's what's happening here, that it's an idiom that essentially means to establish mindfulness, and that parimukhang is really just reinforcing. There's a meaning of a, in one of the Sanskrit texts, has the reading pratimukhang at that point, and pratimukhang has an attested sense in Sanskrit of presence. So perhaps the real meaning of it is actually sort of establishes like a presence of mindfulness, which would just mean to be mindful, really. So sorry if I'm going on too long with the technical explanations. Please feel free to just watch your breath if this is all too boring for you. But one of the principles that I use in interpreting, especially I use in translation, is what I call the principle of least meaning. And principle of least meaning is probably the most powerful and useful guideline that I had for doing my translations. And what the principle of meaning says is that we usually tend to overinterpret things. We tend to assign too much meaning to things, and that's especially true when it comes to ancient sacred texts. The text is just there. It says what it says. Poor little text, right? It's poor little sutta, and all it says is parimukhang satingo patapetwa. It's three little words, and yet so much commentary and discussion and so on, And the tendency is to overburden the text with meaning and interpretation and to read too much into it. And when you read that it means establishing mindfulness in a specific physical location, then you're reading quite a lot of meaning into it, because that meaning isn't attested anywhere else in the suttas. Right? So you're saying that this is that word contains a specific and quite important meaning, right? If that's what it means, it has a real impact on people's lives and the way they approach meditation. And so we're creating that sense of meaning. And so that's the kind of thing which I would say, well, let's recognize that we tend to overinterpret things. So we interpret in the way that has the least meaning. So in this case, the least meaning means, well, it's basically a synonym of another word which is already in that phrase, so that whether that word is there or not doesn't really change the meaning of the sentence very much. So that's the kind of the principle that I try to use when interpreting these things.
Is that how the traditions also start? Because in some traditions there's a lot of emphasis on that particular.
Absolutely, yeah.
In that tradition, it's very important that you really focus here.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So that's how the different traditions.
Right, and often you find that because some of these points will be interpreted differently in different places or by different teachers, so then you'll end up with sometimes the different practices and so on because of that. Yeah. Sorry, Ramai, what your second question was? Oh, the aramana, right, yeah. So the basic meaning of aramana is support. In the suttas, it's always used in that sense. And so you have a phrase like, say, aramanang, vosaga aramanang karitva labhati samadhin labhati cittasekaggatang. Relying on or supported by letting go, one gains samadhi, one gains one pointedness of mind. So in that kind of sense, it doesn't mean with letting go as the object, but it just means letting go is what supports your mind to find peace. So that's the way that aramana is used in the early suttas. As far as I know, I don't think that there are any exceptions to that. Like, I don't think that there's anywhere where it's used in the sense of an object. So in the later suttas, they have the idea of dhamma aramana, and that phrase you don't find in the suttas. I think it first occurs in the Abhidhamma, but I'd have to check up. I haven't studied the history of it. But it certainly was a very common usage in the Visuddhimagga period. No. I don't think so, no. Yeah. Yep. Okay, we should probably finish up there. Let's finish by doing the closing chanting.